Yeah, so as Philip has already said, I'm going to share my story. You know, there is a lot of things about football, but I always say this, you'll hear the football story, but football was just a job. And I say just a job because when you're paid to do something and your life involves earning wages from it, it's a job. And we're, you know, most of us in this room have worked or are still working or, you know, or looking for work. But even though you're working, life still continues. And that's the big thing about what you'll hear tonight. You'll hear similar things. You'll recognise similar things in your own lives because life carries on. The difference for me was that on Saturday and Tuesday, I was judged by the results that I got or the performance that I put in, no matter what was going on in my life. So, and it would be the same for you guys. You know, there'd be things happening and you're judged by your performances, but sometimes it's easy to shut the door, whereas for us as a family, it was happening all the time. You're judged every single day. But it's not a pity story tonight. It's not a pity story. It's just a life story. So, anyway, to prove that I played football once upon a time, we've got a DVD. It's got my career highlights. Oh, sorry. No. Anyway, I can tell you about it. I scored 150 goals. Not really. Not really. Oh, no, thank you anyway. Thank you. So I could tell you anything. Okay. So what I would say then, it's not going to show. If it does work by the end, we'll flick it up. But it's 4 minutes worth of my career. I played football for nearly 20 years. They could only get 4 minutes worth of footage. And there was a few goals on there. Not many, just a few. But it was in colour. So that was good. It wasn't in HD or anything like that. So you know it wasn't too long ago. Okay, we won't show that. But maybe if we can flick something up later on, we will. I'll tell you about my family. So I'm married. I've been with my wife, Trish, for 27 years. We have three children. Nathan, who is 24, who is now training to be a tree surgeon. He went to university to do sports science and came out now a tree surgeon. Not quite sure how that adds up, but hey, he's happy in what he's doing, so which is good. My daughter, Atlanta, she's 21. She's living in America. But before she went to America, she used to play football for Chelsea and England, so she was doing really well, but then decided that she wanted to pursue her football career and studies in America. And officially, she's the best footballer in the Primus family because she has more international caps than me. I never got any, so she only had to get one to beat me. So she's officially the best footballer in the family. And my younger son, Cameron, who is 16, just started college, and he likes it. It's amazing. He likes it, so I'm happy with that. And we've got two dogs, two chocolate Labradors called Ben and Jerry. So that's the Primus family. My mum's here tonight, and mum and dad live down in Portsmouth as well. They moved across from London about 10 years ago. So we're all there. My brother's still in London. We can't woo him out yet, so but hey, maybe one day. So that's the Primus family, and let's take you back to the beginning. So I used to live in Stratford, East London, and I lived there for 21 years. For 19 of those years, I lived in a high-rise block of flats, looking out towards Essex. In the way was West Ham. West Ham Football Club was in the way. Their floodlights would be shining bright. And when you grew up in East London, West Ham were the team to follow. Had big history. You know, I think that there's a rumour that most of the West Ham team won the World Cup, but I'm not taking credit for that in any way. But West Ham was an iconic club. Back in the day. So that was a real focus point. But I like sports. I generally liked a lot of sports. And but because my parents are from the Caribbean, my dad tried to get me into cricket. And cricket was fun until that little ball hit me. And when it hit me, it hurt. And I said, I'm never playing cricket again. So cricket stopped. And it wasn't until I was about 8 years old that football came alive for me. I watched the cup final between Tottenham and Manchester City. One of the guys from Tottenham scores an amazing goal. And I think to myself, as an 8-year-old, if he can do it, so can I. That was literally the thought process. But because I didn't play for a team, there was no young teams at that stage, I made a football pitch in my mum and dad's flat in the corridor, using one door as a goal and using their bedroom door as a goal and playing against my teddy bears. And I used to win. I used to score lots of goals. I was all right. I was the man. But then when I was 12 years old, I started to play football for a little Sunday team, which was quite difficult for my parents because we were churchgoers, but church wasn't relevant. Church, as a young kid, you know, being Sunday school, I was part of the Cub Scouts and things like that. But church wasn't relevant. I'd rather be outside playing with my friends and playing football. So when my parents allowed me to go and play, it was amazing for me. It was a really special time. It was really special until we probably three or four games in, I realised we were rubbish as a team. We used to get beat, you know, 15-0 would be the lowest scoreline. You know, anything above 20, you know, it was like, oh, normal Sunday, you know. I need to get back in church, you know, sort of thinking. But we started to improve, and the manager of that team said one day, he sat us down and he said, guys, he said, you've got a bright future. And he said, I'm going to give every single one of you boys an opportunity to go on in football. He said, because I really feel that you've got the attributes to go into at least schoolboy football at professional clubs. And when he didn't have to do that, he didn't have to say that, but he said because of things that had gone wrong in his life, he felt that he didn't want us to go down that pathway. So he wrote to all the clubs in London, told them that that the team had good players, get your scouts to come and watch us. So most clubs wrote back and said, scouts will come, we've heard about you, they'll come over. But Charlton Athletic wrote back and said, bring your team over to play us. So we thought, oh, that's lovely, what an opportunity. And we were in East London, we had to go across the River Thames to South London and play Charlton. But some of the boys, because they'd never been across the Thames, thought they were going to France or something like that. So a couple of them bought passports as well, you know. I was one of them. So we went across, we played them, we got beat 6-0, but that was fine. That was like a win, you know, 6-0, great. But from that team, the team that played Charlton, five got asked to go back and train with Charlton so they could watch us on with training with their elite players, and I was one of the five. So as a 14-year-old, my journey in the football world had started, in professional football had started. Even though I wasn't a professional, I was now in a professional setup. Very quickly I realised, you know what, you have to be good to be in this environment, because all the players in that environment were very good. And I realised as well, it was about your attitude, having the right attitude, because to train and play every week and learn something different, improving yourself, you had to be keen to learn, you had to want to learn. And because I wasn't the most technically gifted footballer, I used to work really hard, you know, with my fitness and doing extra training, because I wanted to be in there, I wanted it so bad. Not that the other boys didn't want it as bad as me, but I just wanted it so bad. So I'd done whatever I could to stay in that system. Anyway, as I got to 16 years old, done my GCSEs, and as a 16-year-old, you then get told whether or not Charlton or any professional club want to keep you on, and you can become an apprentice. So 40 boys are training on a Tuesday night. It's April. And 35 boys were told that Tuesday night their future at Charlton was over. I was one of the five that got told my future is still at Charlton, and now I was going to be training full-time with them. And I remember looking, like I had this excitement, but I also saw the disappointment, not just for those, you know, a lot of them were my teammates and friends, but with their parents as well, you know, and you saw how football can emotionally lift you up and drop you down. And I thought to myself, I never, ever want to be the player that's rejected. I don't want to be in that group ever. But then there's a little fear with that. So anyway, a few days later, I'm ready to sign for Charlton. I get a message from West Ham United saying, Linvoy, we would like you to be an apprentice with us. And I'm thinking, I can't, what am I going to do? West Ham are the big club now. And I remember saying to my dad, Dad, look, West Ham want me, Charlton want me, what should I do? My dad said, go with your heart, Lynn. And I thought, heart. I was like, Dad, don't give me that heart stuff. Just tell me, you know. You tell me all the other times. And I knew what he was saying. Where do you feel most comfortable? And I had this thing about loyalty because I'd seen it all around me. You know, I'd seen loyalty and I thought, actually, Charlton gave me my opportunity first. I'm going to go with Charlton, stick with Charlton. So I signed this contract with Charlton, which would now mean that I was training every day. I was also, as an apprentice, it wasn't just about learning to play football, but it was also taking care of the facilities around. So we had to look after our pros' kit. We had to clean the dressing rooms. We had to clean the toilets and the showers. And everybody was allocated a job. And you can imagine 10, 16-year-old boys doing jobs around the facilities. It's not going to go well. You know, we're not going to do it properly. And the manager would always pull us up and say, guys, if you don't do your jobs well, I can tell what sort of footballer you're going to be. If I can't trust you with the little things, how can I trust you with things on the football pitch? So do your jobs well. So I took that on board because I thought, and he always said, you never know who's watching, so do it well. So I did. I just carried on doing the things well that I was asked to do. But I realised as well that environment was difficult. When you go from, as a young boy in school, into an environment where there's men training all the time and, you know, there's a lot of bravado, it's different. And you've got to be strong in that environment. You can't show any weakness. And I found that really hard. But I thought, if I can change outwardly, that'll be fine. But inwardly, I didn't like it. But I had to fit in. Because if you didn't fit in, you know, people would let you know. So I had 2 years as an apprentice. And at the end of 2 years, I got told that I was going to get a professional contract. So that was the best moment for me. It really was. Only two professional contracts got offered that year. From the age of 14 through to 18, I trained and played with 60 footballers. And out of all of them, only two professional contracts. And I'll tell you now, I wasn't the best, but I just worked really hard. And I remember the manager saying to me, Linvoy, you've done well to get this contract. Well done. But he said, that's the easiest one. And I thought, the easiest? I've just beaten, you know, 58 other guys to get this. He said, now, your contract, thank you. He said, now, the next contract you earn, you've got to now try and get into the team. You've now got to try and work with older pros who have got mortgages, who've got families, who've got bills, and they won't want you in the team. So you've got to work extra hard. And I thought, I was feeling really good at the beginning of this, and now he's telling me that my next contract's the one I've got to earn. But that's what it's like. You have to earn your next contract. You can't just relax on the one you've got. So anyway, that was fine. Within a year and a half, I then play my first game for Charlton, live on TV, get man of the match. Amazing. Great start. At the end of the game, I get a big bottle of champagne and I have to do an interview. And the interview is the worst interview ever because Charlton had no money. And I told everybody in that interview that Charlton had no money. So it wasn't great. It wasn't the best interview for me. And I remember walking in afterwards and all the players were like, Linvoy, well done, well done. And I thought I'd arrived. I thought, this is it. My career in football is going to go on forever now. And I remember just leaving the dressing room and I head on home. And one of the players said to me, Lynn, how are you going to get home? So I said, oh, I'm going to get the bus. He said, what do you mean to get the bus? I said, well, that's how I got here. I got here on the bus. He said, you can't go on the bus. All the fans are going to be out there. You're going to have to get a taxi. It was like the whole world stopped for a moment. So I thought to myself, taxi? Anybody that's made it travels in a taxi, and I'm going to go in a taxi. So I remember getting out, and they phoned up the taxi for me, and I walked outside and signing autographs, and I'm in the taxi thinking, this is it. This is what life's going to be like for the rest of my football career. 6 games later, I got told by Charlton that I could leave the club. Sorry, not leave the club. I was out of the team, and a year after that, I was told by Charlton that I can leave the club, that my future was over at Charlton. And that hurt. That hurt. That was the first time I'd faced rejection. That was the first time I'd failed. All the emotions of failure were now surrounded with my family, because I knew that I had to look after my family. Nathan was 6 months old. I was living with Trish. She was my girlfriend then. And it was, I was thinking, my life's over. The only thing that I've struggled for and wanted so badly is now over. What do I do now? And I remember driving away from the training ground after the manager told me that it was over, and just bursting into tears. And I had this moment where I thought, right, Lynn, you're either going to have to get a proper job and work 9 to 5 or stay in football. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and stay in football. Because when you stay in football, you only have to work 10 till 2, you know, and I like those hours, they're shorter hours. But I wasn't trained to do anything else. That's the bottom line. I wasn't trained to do anything else. I had no qualifications. And all the guys I'd left school with at 16 had 4 years head start on me in terms of further education or working. So I was coming in at another level. But I thought, no, I'm going to try and stay in football. At that period of time, there's probably about 500 footballers who are all out of contract. We're all unemployed. You know, no, you have no right to stay in football. We're all unemployed. So I had I didn't have Liverpool knocking on the door saying, Linvoy, we've seen that you played a few games, we want to sign you. Didn't have anything like that. But then after 6 weeks, I got a phone call from Cardiff. And Cardiff said, Linvoy, would you like to come and train with us? And I said, okay, I'll go. Not sure if I really want to move out of London. What's it going to be like for the family? But we'll go. 2 days after that, I get a phone call from Barnet. And the manager of Barnet was a guy called Ray Clements. And for me, Ray was an absolute legend, because I was a bit of a Tottenham fan. And Ray played for Tottenham, he played for Liverpool, and he played for England. So when he rang me, I thought it was one of my friends messing about. So I didn't really take it serious. And then I realised it was him when he said, Linvoy, this is Ray Clements. And I thought, it must be, because you don't repeat your name in that stern voice if it's not you. So I said, hi, Ray. He said, Linvoy, we'd like you to come to Barnet. I'm manager of Barnet. I'd like you to come to Barnet and have a trial. And I said, Ray, thank you very much, but Cardiff have asked me to go for a trial, and I've got to honour that. I've got to show them some loyalty. I've got to go there. And Ray said, are you sure? And I said, yep, definitely. Cardiff, if that doesn't work, then I'll come to you. So he said, Lynn, give me 5 minutes. I'm going to speak to the chairman, and I'll come back to you. So I said, okay, Ray, that's fine, but I'm going to Cardiff. So he phones back, and he said, Lynn, there's a 2-year contract on the table. What would you like to do? I said, Ray, I'll be there in 5 minutes. I was like, forget Cardiff. Who Cardiff, you know? And I saw when I made that decision to not go to West Ham and stick with Charlton, I'd done it through loyalty, but I saw what loyalty offered. You know, I was unemployed. When Barnet offered me this contract, it was security. I didn't care what league they were in, I didn't care where they were in the country, it was security for 2 years. So Ray put the phone down, he said, you know, come with your dad, sign the contract. And I said, thanks, Ray, I'll be there. So I put the phone down, I thought, I wonder where Barnet is. So I opened up the map and I was like, oh, it's in London. Oh, that's handy. So I went along, signed a 2-year contract. And the first year was really difficult, really difficult, because I played with a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear, because I didn't want to face rejection again. But what was different now, I was playing in front of fans who had an expectation. And it was like, how do I cope with that? And I couldn't show any weakness, so it was all internal. So inside, it was horrible. I was angry. I was disappointed. Sometimes I'd start a game, and I'd be so nervous. I couldn't run, you know, and I couldn't tell my teammates. And it was like a crazy world. And I'm thinking, I just want to play football, but it's different. And because I didn't tell anybody, I just thought, I need to cope. How can I cope? And the one way I could cope was being as angry as possible at Charlton. Because I thought, if I can prove them wrong, that'd be great. That's what I've got to do. And it got me through. It got me through for 2.5 years, 3 years at Barnet. It got me through. Because every season I was close to being a player of the year and having some great performances. But it was never enough. It was never enough. It was like, it didn't matter how much football was satisfying me, it still didn't satisfy me enough. And the one thing that used to wind me up but I couldn't let my friends know this, was you used to get ratings every week in the paper. You used to get, you know, a mark out of 10. So my friends would phone me up Monday, guaranteed, Monday morning, Lynn, we're just looking in the sun, and you've got a 6 out of 10. You must have been rubbish at the weekend. I'd say, look, have a look in the Daily Mirror. I've got an 8 out of 10. And they go, oh, yeah. And I say, look, the sun's rubbish. Don't read that. Just anyway, the following week, Lynn, we're looking in the Daily Mirror, and you've got a 4 out of 10. You must be rubbish. And I say, look, have a look in the sun. I've got a 6 out of 10. But it used to wind me up, but I couldn't show them. But, you know, that's when I realised that my life as a footballer was visible to everybody. And even though I was having the torment inside and the fear inside, I couldn't allow anybody to see what I was going through. Anyway, got to 3 years, I got a transfer to Reading. And Reading were in the same division as Charlton. We moved out as a family. We now had Nathan and Atlanta. As a family, we moved to Didcot, not too far from here. And when we moved, it was an opportunity to say, this is it. This, a little bit of my life was, this is what I've yearned for, a home, car, family. This is what I've yearned for, but still not enough, still not quite enough. And then I thought, you know what? You know what's going to complete everything? Playing against Charlton, we're in the same division, and beating Charlton. And when that happens, there'll be peace throughout the world, literally. So anyway, Reading play Charlton. I'd been preparing for this moment for 3 years. For 3 years. I'd be brushing my teeth in the evening, looking in the mirror, thinking, right, there's the manager. This is what I'm going to say to him. And I thought, no, Lynn, don't be aggressive. Just be nice. Can't. God, you know, I'm going to tell him. So when the day came to play them, I just knew I was going to play well. I just knew it. It didn't matter what the result was going to be, I just knew I was going to play well. We play them and we beat them. So I'm happy. I'm so happy. It's like we've won the FA Cup. And then the manager of Charlton was the same manager that said I wasn't good enough. So this is it. This is the moment. I've got all my lines rehearsed, you know. This is the moment. And I go across to him. I put my hand out. He reluctantly puts his hand out. We shake hands, and he tries to pull away, but I hold on. He tries to pull away again, but I hold on. And then he just says to me, Linvoy, well done. You've proved us wrong. I was like, oh, great. He stole my thunder. It was like all my energy to say what he'd done to me and my family. He'd just taken away by saying, well done. I was like, oh, great, you know, and I walked off. You know, it should have been one of the happiest moments for me. And I walked off and I thought, now what? Now what? I was 24, 25 years old. I'm now a footballer. You know, I'm now recognised as a footballer. And when you're recognised as a footballer, there's an expectation that comes with that. And whatever the expectation was, that's what people expected from me and from my wife. And I thought, you know what, I'm a footballer, but I'm still not happy. What's going to make me happy? Money. Money will make me happy. I'm going to chase money now. So chase money for a little bit of time. And then in that time, Trish develops depression. And in that moment, it's like, you know, you can have everything you want. But when this illness comes, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. And even with her illness, I'm thinking to myself, why are we just not happy now? You know, why? What is it? What do we need? And I asked the question. There must be more to life than this. Because if I've, in the world of football, from the age of 8 years old, wanting to be a footballer, I'm now a footballer, and I'm still not happy, there must be more to life. And my contract was just running out at Reading, and we'd had a number of different managers, a lot of things had happened, but the biggest, two big things that happened while I was at Reading, I got ripped off by two agents, left us financially in a really, really bad place, and secondly, we were really lonely as a couple, as a family, because we realised that because of the job that I'd done, people wanted to be our friends through that. It wasn't about knowing who we were as people. So we were really lonely. And once my contract had run out at Reading, decided that was it, I'm going to quit football. I was 27, and I said, I want my wife well. So let's get back to London, where everybody knows us for who we are, not the job that I do. And heading back to London, and I got a phone call from Tony Pulis, who was the Portsmouth manager. And Tony said, Linvoy, I hear you've left Reading. I would like you to come and have a trial at Portsmouth. And in my head, I thought, a trial? I was tired. That's where I was. I was tired. In my head, I was tired. And I thought, a trial? I've got to prove myself again. I'd played against about four different teams that Tony Pulis managed. So he knew what I could do, but yet I had to go for a trial. And I think deep down, it was, here we go, prove yourself again. And that's what you're continually doing, proving yourself. And I remember putting the phone down and turning to Trish and saying, Trish, Portsmouth have asked me to go and have a trial. I'm not sure if I'm going to do it. And she said, you're going. And I said, what do you mean you're going? And she said, you're going. And I said, oh, I don't really want to. She said, you're going. She said, where are we going to get any money? You know, how are we going to live? So you better go. So I was like, oh, great, you know, grumble, grumble. But I went, and I went, and I had this trial. It lasted 2 weeks, and I signed a professional contract. We moved to Portsmouth, and for a short period of time, things were great. You know, the depression had gone, life was good. But it was like we'd left everything behind at Reading, and we could start again. But within, you know, 6 months, 6 to 8 months, the depression came back, and it was dark, it was hard, it was really hard. In that time, two managers had come into Portsmouth, and so you got to prove yourself again. And I'm thinking, there's got to be more, there's got to be more. I started to read books about self-help and positive thinking. I think there's got to be more. And then one day I came home from training and Trish said to me, Lynn, I think I'd like to get a horse. And I thought, a horse? And I remember thinking to myself, you know what, we've got no pets. You know, we could have started with a rabbit or a cat, you know, or a dog, but a horse. And I remember looking in the garden thinking, our garden's small. How's a horse going to fit in the garden? And I said, why a horse? And she said, well, before we left Reading, I helped out at stables. And she said, the people at the stables treated me as Trish. They didn't treat me as the footballer's wife. And I really feel if I'm in that community again, I can be me and it will help. I thought, all right then. And I thought, God, horses are expensive. And we didn't really have a lot of spare money. So I'm going, oh, how are we going to do this? Anyway, we got some money through that we weren't expecting. So we bought this horse. And probably after about 2 months, we realised it was a wonky donkey. You know, it wasn't great. It had every illness going, you know. And every time that we'd get the phone call, it's like, oh, no. That phone call means we've got to phone the vet and that's going to cost them. You know, so anyway, it was called the Wonky Donkey. And but where we kept the horse, these guys at the stable said, look, don't keep getting the vet out. There's medication that we've got that you can give to the horse. You know, just pay us. So we were a bit naive, and we'd done that for a couple of times. And then somebody else in the stable said to my wife, Trish, you should really get expert advice, because the only reason they're saying to you, don't go to the vet, is because they can get more money from you by getting the medication from them. And that really hurt Trish, because she realised then that these guys knew that I played football and it's just another way of drawing money down. So it broke her heart, because she thought she was making friends. And so we ended up moving the horse to a new stables. These stables were a little bit more expensive just because it was a little bit cleaner. You know, I wasn't into horses, so I didn't quite know why it had to be a bit more. Anyway, Trish settles really well. And it looks like it's going well. And then she came home to me a few months later and just said, Lynn, these guys at the stables are nice people. I thought, good, she's making friends. And then she said, they're Christians. And I said, what? She said, they're Christians. I said, Trish, stay away. And she's like, she said, why? They're nice. And I said, they'll start off like that, Trish, you know, and it'll all change. They'll want something. And then you know what? They'll invite you to church. And I said, if they invite you to church, say no. You know, no. Anyway, 2 weeks later, we're in church. So, you know, But the thing about this couple who invited Trish to church was they saw something was wrong. And they helped her, they spoke to her, and they just said, why don't you come to church? You tried everything else, why don't you come to church? So when she said, you know, she'd like to go, I thought, I can't let her go on her own. I remember what church was like as a kid. And actually, if it's the same, oh, it could be difficult. So I said, look, let's go, but why don't we just give them 6 weeks? We're not going to go once and then embarrass them and say we're not going again. Let's give them a little window of time. So Trish said, yeah, that's fine. We'll do that. So anyway, we got, and I had three rules for that for going to that church. The first rule was don't get eye contact with anyone. Second rule was do not shake hands. Third rule, do not smile. Anyway, on the way to church, I'm in my head, three rules, Lynn. Anyway, I broke those rules in about 2 minutes. I smiled, I shook hands, I got eye contact. But we go into this, we pull up into this car park, and I'm looking and thinking, whoa, this don't look like a church. It's too modern. Can't be. And I thought, you know what? I bet you they've changed their venue this week. I bet you they're in the other place next week. Anyway, so we go in, and there's chairs set out, and I'm thinking to myself, where's the pews? Where's the organ? And I'm having a good look round. I'm thinking, there's a band up the front. Something's not right. Anyway, the music starts to play, and I think, Lynn, do not get into this. But my foot's tapping uncontrollably, and I'm thinking, this is all right. Then someone looks around, and I'm like, no, don't like it. Don't like it. A few songs play, we sit down, and a guy gets up to speak. And as he gets up, I'm thinking, that can't be the vicar. Surely not. He's got shorts and T-shirt on. Can't be. And you know, when you're a kid, when we used to go to Church of England, so he used to have the full robes on, but I never saw his feet, so I used to think he glided in. So I'm thinking, where is he? Where's this guy that's going to glide in? Anyway, this guy gets up to speak, and he starts reading from the Bible, and then starts telling his own story, and then starts talking about having it all and being empty. I'm thinking to myself, he's talking about me. I thought, I've never told anybody how I'm feeling. How does he know? And he's going on, and I'm leaning in because I like it. I really like it. And then he says, his life changed when he met Jesus. And I went, oh, he's only mentioned a J word. I know we're in church, but he's mentioned a J word. And I'm like, how can this guy talk about Jesus like he's real, like he's alive? And that's what he said in the end. He said, I've met Jesus and he's alive. And I thought, this guy's mad. This guy's mad. Anyway, the service finishes. We leave the church. Kids are in the car. I'm driving. Trish sat on in the passenger seat. And I say to Trish, what did you think then? She said, yeah, I thought it was all right. She said to me, what did you think? I said, yeah, it was all right. But deep down, I thought it was great. And this is when you know that when things are changing in your life and you start to understand more about God, you'll hear stuff now that you'll think, wow, I know God's hand was on my life. But at the time, you're like, coincidence. So, Portsmouth, we've gone to church. None of the players know. I haven't told any of the players. But I know there's one player who's a Christian. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to ask him questions. I'm going to secretly ask him why he believes what he believes. And then I'm going to ask the guys in church the same questions. Because this guy, my teammate, will not know these guys in church. Because two different groups won't know them. So I'll ask the questions. And the reason I knew he was a proper Christian, because on a Friday night when we had an away game, we used to room together. And he'd bring his kit bag and he'd pull out this thick book. And I'm thinking to myself, you know what, footballers don't read. And if they do, they like pictures in there, you know. And I'm thinking, it's got to be a proper Bible. So anyway, so I start asking him, and he goes to the Bible for his answers. And I'm thinking, why does he keep going to the Bible? Doing my head in. But he's 6'4", and he's a big lad. And I'm thinking, I can't tell him he's doing my head in. And when he got a bit too heavy, I was like, that's it. That's enough for me. And I thought, right, I know the answers. Go to church tomorrow morning, and I'll ask the same questions. I'd ask the same questions. They had the same answers. And I'm thinking to myself, you know what? He's phoned them up. He's phoned them up, definitely phoned them up, and told them what I'm going to ask. Anyway, Obviously, that wasn't happening. But I was so skeptical. I didn't trust anybody. I didn't want to let anybody in my life. So this went on for about 6 weeks. And in the end, I thought, I cannot prove this guy wrong. I cannot prove that Jesus isn't alive. What he said he'd done, I can't prove it's wrong. But there's some things I need to know. I need some answers for some certain things. So I thought, right, let's invite the guys round to our house that invited us to church. Because I thought, you know what, they're going to be on my territory and I'm going to grill them. You know, grill a Christian. That was the phrase I used. So they were around our house and I asked them some questions, some hard questions. They kept going to the Bible, which annoyed me, and come back with some answers. And some of the answers they gave me I didn't like. And then I just said, tell me what it is. Tell me why you believe what you believe. And they just ran me through the story of God, of Adam and Eve. They ran me through it. And they just started with this. They said, Lynn, God created the world. He created the heavens and the earth. Bible says it here. And then he created man, and then he created woman. And then at that point, he was having great time with him. He was having a relationship with them. Great. But then they disobeyed God by eating a fruit off a tree that they shouldn't have. And you know what? And I remember hearing these stories in Sunday school. I remember hearing the stories, but they weren't relevant because Christmas was about presents and Easter was about eggs. You know, there was no relevance. But all of a sudden, it started to make sense. And then he said, and they were saying to me, Lynn, so Adam and Eve disobeyed God. And at that point, it brought a separation between man and God. And you know what, Lynn? Even though that has happened, God has to judge that. And I'm like, what do you mean by that? They said, we won't go into detail of that, but God, if you don't do something about that, God has to judge that at some point because it's against him. I was like, oh, I still don't get it, but okay, go on a little bit more. And he said, but even though God has to judge that, he'd done the greatest thing. That price that has to be paid, that moment where God says, you don't know me, he sent Jesus on the cross to die on the cross for you. You know what? Something hit me. But he said, more importantly, Jesus rose on the third day. And because he rose on the third day, you've got a choice to make. Because if you can believe that, you can have a relationship with God. You can live the life that God has set out for you. Whoa, and I was thinking to myself, this is deep. But I'd never heard that before. Never, ever heard that. And I said, okay then, what do I have to do? And they said, Lynn, just say a little prayer, acknowledging that you want to follow Jesus. You believe what he done for you on the cross. You believe you can have that relationship with God. And you can live your life following him. I said, all right then, I'll say this prayer. So I go to close my eyes and I think, I'm not doing this on my own. And I turn to Trish and I say, Trish, why don't we say the prayer together? She said, Lynn, I've already said it. And I said, what? What do you mean you've already said it? And she said, the week before, she'd taken the kids to Bognor Regis, good old Bognor Regis, Butlins at Bognor Regis. And the guys at church had given her some books. And one of them was a Why Jesus booklet, thin booklet, explaining the relationship that God wanted with us. And at the end of it, you could say this little prayer. And I said, you said the prayer? She said, yes. And I said, what happened? She said, as I finished the prayer, she said the depression just went, gone. And I knew that was real for two reasons. We tried every different place to move that depression. We went everywhere to try and get rid of that. It never went. So when she said that, I knew that was real. But the second thing, which was more significant, the first day we walked into that church, she didn't even believe in God. But yet 6 weeks later, she has said that Jesus is her Lord and Saviour. I'm thinking, yeah, if she can believe that. Because she's the sort of girl that if she doesn't like something, she'll tell you. So once she said, I thought, yeah, okay. I thought, right, if she's in, I'm in. So I closed my eyes. I said, I want to say this prayer. The guys stand up and start to pray, and I follow this little prayer. And at the end, like my head's bowed, my hands are together, and at the end I say, Amen. They open up one eye and have a little look. Because we're in our house, you know, and I'm thinking, right, when's God going to point his hand in and say, Linville, you're the man? Nothing happened. It was like, and I said, is that it? And they said, yes. The only funny thing that was going on at that moment, the guy that prayed with me tried to hug me. And I went, uh-uh, I don't do those hugs, man. I don't do those hugs. By the way, I do them now. I do them now. And he said, Lynn, he said, it's the best decision you've ever made. You know what? That's it. He said, you need to tell a few people what you've done. I'm thinking, right, okay, I'll tell my teammate because I know he's a Christian. There's a Brazilian player. I'm sure he's a Christian. And there's one other guy. I think he's a Christian. So I'll tell them tomorrow. So anyway, I tell my teammate. His name's Darren. I say to Darren, Darren, I've done it. And he said, Lynn, I know. I could see it. And I said, see what? He said, I could see it in your face. I said, see what? I thought, I put moisturizer on. What can you see? You know? He said, I can see it, man. I can see it. And he hugged me. And I didn't have a chance to escape. You know, he 6'4" and like I say. But the Brazilian guy was exactly the same. And he shared his testimony of how he had become a Christian and what had happened in his life. And another guy. And it meant so much for these three guys. But it didn't mean nothing for me. So the guys were saying to me, Lynn, read the Bible. You know, it makes sense. Read the gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I started to read it. Didn't really understand it, but something was happening inside. And Darren said to me, Lynn, there's a chaplain at the football club, a guy called Mick Mellows, who used to play. He said, we can meet him once a week. We can ask him questions. We can read the Bible. We can pray together. So I said, great, we'll do that. So I'm asking him more questions, asking him because I really want to just prove that this is still not right. But I could see something in these Christians' eyes that I'd never seen before. I could see peace. I could see peace. They were settled. They were happy. And I thought, oh, that's what I want. That's what I want. So it got to 6 weeks doing these Bible studies, and I had a knee injury. And I remember being in church. It was a Sunday morning, and the guy said, Lynn, we know you got your knee injury. Can we pray for you? And I said, look, you can pray for me, but let me let you into a little secret. I don't think I'm a Christian. I don't think that prayer was enough. Because in life, you have to buy things. You have to pay for things. And actually, what you've said, praying, God relationship with me, I don't think that's right. And I said, tell me some things then. Tell me some things about God that can prove. Because I'm a science guy. If you're telling me that's a chair, I'm going to sit in that chair and, you know, that chair is going to hold me up. So I know that. But you're telling me this little prayer has now give me access to God and, you know, and all that. So I said, tell me some stuff. So they started to show me some stuff in the Bible, and I'm thinking, all right, okay. And then they said, there was a little thing they read about God healing people. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I thought, I've got a knee injury. I said, all right, tell me some more. And then there was another verse about God's power. I thought, oh, that's interesting, because I know I can't make anything happen. So they said, and I said, right, okay, guys, I'll believe I'm a Christian if I'm healed and I feel God's power. Done deal. I said, all right then. So they pray for me in church. And at the end of the prayer, you know, the old amen. And they said, Lynn, how do you feel? And I go to walk off and I went, oh, it's worse. You know, I was like, oh, thanks for your prayers, you know. So I go home, still doubting whether I'm a Christian or not. Go to training. Get to Wednesday. So I had that in church Sunday. Get to Wednesday. Going for this Bible study and prayer time with the chaplain and my teammate, Darren. And we're partway through the Bible study, and the chaplain just says, Lynn, can we stop for a minute? Can we pray for you? And I'm like, oh, great. He said, can we pray for your knee? And I'm like, oh, man. I thought, I'll just humour them, you know, because I know what happened Sunday, and I know it's not going to work, but I'll just humour them. So I sit in the chair. We're in his office, sit in the chair, and they put their hands on my knee. And I'm thinking, all right, go for it, guys, go for it. So they start praying, and I can feel electric in my knee. And I'm thinking to myself, my eyes are closed, by the way. And I'm thinking, right, I need to sneakily look at their hands because they must have electric buzzers on their hands. So they finish praying, and they move their hands, nothing on their hands. And I can still feel this electric only in my knee. And I thought, whoa. So they said, Lynn, how's your knee feel? So I'm like, actually, it feels all right. I thought, I've got to make it hurt because it shouldn't be all right. Because I know, I've been told a couple of weeks before that I will probably need surgery and it's going to be a problem. So I'm like, then I thought, you know what, they've hypnotized me. They must have hypnotized me because I've got no pain. I said, Lynn, can we pray for you again? So I said, all right, go on, Liam, you can pray for me again. So I just stand there, and they pray for me again. And all I can tell you, for the next hour, hour and a half, total peace from head to toe. And it wasn't, I chased peace in so many different places. This peace was just internal. And it wasn't anything that they said, they done, but I just knew at that point that I'd met Jesus. I knew it. I just knew it. And this quiet voice just kept on saying, you said you'd believe you're a Christian if your knees healed and you felt my power. And I thought to myself, only the guys in church knew that. My teammate and the chaplain didn't know I had this conversation. And that was it. And while I was there, I just said, Lord, whatever you want me to do, I'll do. Because I just knew it. I just knew it. I tell you all that for this period now, because I thought that being a Christian was about being a good person and going to church on Sunday. That's what I thought Christianity was about. I didn't realise that football and faith and Christianity could all work together. I thought they're two separate worlds. They'll never, ever work together. But within 2 years, I realised that actually Sunday morning was the icing on the cake. The other 6 days, where stuff was happening at the football club, that was amazing, absolutely amazing. Because the club chaplain said, Lynn, wherever God has placed you, that's where he wants you to tell. That's where he wants you to tell other people about him. I thought, I'm not telling anybody, you know, I'm keeping this to myself. But three amazing things happened. The first was, after I was healed, I got into the team and I had to do an article for the local paper. And I knew, I said in my heart, if I play this game, I'm going to do an interview afterwards and I'm going to tell everybody. But to do an interview, you have to be the man of the match. I play this game, I'm man of the match, and I'm thinking, oh no, I'm going to have to do this interview. So I sit down with the journalist and I say to him, look, before we start, I've got to tell you something. I've just become a born-again Christian. He said, oh, so am I. And I thought, what? And he told me his story, and I'm like, oh, wow. Okay, and I told him, and he printed it, and it went in the local paper, and I thought, that's it. It's not going to go any further. Then it got in the national paper. And I'm like, oh, great, you know, everyone's going to think I'm mad. My teammates thought I was mad. They actually thought I was mad. And they gave me so much stick. And Mick, the chaplain, said, Lynn, don't worry about what the lads say, because the Bible has got the answers for everything. Whatever you're going through, the Bible's got the answers for. And I'm thinking, don't know about that. He said, the word of God is living. It's alive today. So I'm like, all right, okay. So the lads are giving me stick, Mick. What should I do? He said, don't worry, Lynn. There's a verse that says, if you're being persecuted in Jesus' name, you're being blessed. And I thought, what's that mean? He said, you're being blessed. Every time someone hammers you about being a Christian, you're being blessed. Because people are not going to like you for what you're standing up for. And I'm like, oh, great. But the lads are hammering me. And you can't be different in there. He said, don't worry, you're being blessed. So I'd walk into training. And they say, hey, here he comes. God squad. Jesus this, Jesus that. Saying horrible things. And it was hurting. Really hurting. And I phone Mick up and say, Mick, I can't take it. He said, don't worry, Lynn, you're being blessed. Don't worry. And I'm thinking, you don't get it. And in the end, I think, all right, I'm being blessed. I don't know what I'm being blessed with, but I'm being blessed. After a year, the guys that started to hammer me then started to say, Linvoy, would you mind praying for a situation in my life? I'd be like, really? They say, yeah, can you pray for me? And I'm like, yeah, well, pray now. They go, no. Go off with the God squad and pray with them, but pray about my situation. I say, of course I can, definitely. And I say, if your situation changes, I say, when your situation changes, come to church with me. They're like, yeah, I'll be there. Anyway, their situation's changed. They never came to church, but that was fine. But there was an acceptance. The second thing that happened was Harry Redknapp became the Portsmouth manager. And Harry, if you know anything about football, Harry is renowned for buying players, changing lots of players around. And the first conversation he had with me was to say that I could leave the club. I'd been at the club 2 seasons, and he said, Lynn, you can leave. And that hurt, because it took me back to when I was 20 years old, that point of rejection. And Harry just said, your future lies elsewhere. so you can go. So I walk out of the office, I'm angry, really angry. Even though I'm a Christian, I'm really angry. And I phone the chaplain up, and the chaplain says, "It's fine, Lynn, don't worry, it's fine." He said, "If God loves you, which he does, he's got a plan for your life. And if you stay at Portsmouth, great. If you go elsewhere, great." And I'm thinking, he's hedging his bets, you know, 50-50. But he said, "Don't worry about it." He said, "God has given you a gift." He said, "Every time you've walked onto that football pitch, you've played for everybody else. Now, play for the one that's given you the gift." And he gave me this verse in Corinthians. It just says, "Whatever you do in word or deed, do it for God." And I'm thinking, "Oh, wow, how do you do that? Because everything in me doesn't want to do this." He said, "Play for God. Do it for God. This is your opportunity to worship God." All right then, put the phone down, thinking he ain't got a clue. Anyway, go into training, the first person I see is Harry Redknapp. Angry, I'm really angry. And again, I just hear that verse, "Do it for God, just do it for God." So I go out and train. "This is for you, God. Train, this is for you, God." 2 weeks later, Harry pulls me to the side and says, "Lynn, your attitude's been great. I don't want to sell you. I want players like you around." And inside I said, "Well, I'm doing this for God, Harry, not you." You know, I said that internally. But externally, I was like, "Oh, thanks, Gaffer. Cheers. Glad my future's here. Thank you." A couple of weeks later, the season starts. I'm not in the team. One of the players gets injured. And Harry says, "Lynn, you're going to go on and play in this position." I think, I've never played that position in my career. But as I walk onto the pitch, I say, "Lord, this is for you." From that game to the end of the season, there's 46 games in the season. I play 44. I win Player of the Year, I win a lot of accolades. And people were saying, "Lynn, what is it? You're so different." I say, "You know why? Because I play for God. I'm a born-again Christian. I play for God." And the journalists start to write, Linvoy Primus says, "Harry Redknapp's God." I'm like, "No, that's not what I said. This is what I said. I play for Jesus." And you know what? Because of that, as I walk onto the pitch, I've got peace. Because for the first time in my entire football career, win, lose or draw, my Father in heaven loves me. He didn't care what the result was. And I thought, I can play 100% knowing that he loves me anyway. Wow. Peace. Total peace. So that was the second significant thing. But the third significant thing was the atmosphere around the club started to change because I was quite vocal because people saw something different on the pitch. And they also saw some stuff going on off the pitch, which I started a charity called Faith in Football. People were starting to see there was something different about Linvoy. They'd seen me play before and I was okay. I'd give my all, but it was okay. But something was different. So this became a bit of a talking point. So the atmosphere around was changing. Players were a bit more accepting about me and my faith. But then when I was starting to pray with Mick on my own now because Darren had moved to a different club. And Mick said to me, "Lynn, I really believe we should pray for the industry." And I'm thinking, "The industry? Just pray for me. You know, I'm getting enough stick." He said, "The industry needs to change. And God can do it." And I'm thinking, "Man, I don't know. God, you're big, but really, football?" And he said, "One of the things, Lynn," he said, "I think we should pray for, we should pray that any player that comes to Portsmouth, God has said they're coming here." And I'm thinking, "Well, he's going on another level now. I'm not quite know where he's going with this." So he said, "Any time a player comes to Portsmouth, we've got to believe that God's brought them here. And when they come, tell them about Jesus." And I'm like, "Oh, great, yeah, you do it in the background and let me go out on front." But we prayed and we prayed. And within 3 years, 9 footballers at Portsmouth are Christians. 5 become Christians who, after they signed for the club, 4 Christian players signed for the club. So at one point, we had 10 footballers on the pitch who were Christians, unheard of. Backroom staff were becoming Christians. There was the guy that used to do the physio. We used to have time slots when we had away games, and he used to always put me in late. I like to be in bed by about 10:30 with a nice cup of milk, you know. he booked me in at 10:30 and started speaking to me about life and Christianity and all sorts of things. I'm thinking, why is he doing this at 1:30 in the morning? I don't want to go to bed. He becomes a Christian, you know, within a year. And all of a sudden, I started to see that where God had placed me. That was my mission field. That was my mission field. And then we just went one step further with those Christian guys. We went one step further and we just said to the manager, Gaffer, on match day, do you mind if we gather together and pray in the kit room? And I'm thinking, there's no way he's going to let this happen. Not a chance. He said, Linvoy, of course you can. Get as many in there as you can because we're losing. So get them all in and we'll pray. No. So anyway, we start these prayer times before games. We have up to 20 players in that room praying. Not for victory, not for us to win the Premier League, because it never happened, but just for us to honour God and glorify him. Amazing. Some guys in there weren't believers. They're probably in there for good luck. Who cares? But they definitely had a touch from God. I could tell you hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories of different things that happened, but can't do that tonight. But one thing I recognise, that when my career finished in 2010, I'd played 7 years in the Premier League at this point. People had written me off time and time again throughout that. So that Christian life wasn't easy, still isn't easy. Really bumpy, really turbulent. But Jesus has walked us through so many different things. I say us because that's my wife, myself, my kids, walked us through so many different things. And when I got to 2010, I retired. I had no fear of the future. I had no fear about what was next, because I got given a couple of verses by a 15-year-old boy who would never have known what these verses were going to do to me. But these verses were talking about God's plans for my life. And when I read it, I thought, oh my God, you love me and you've written out every day of my life. So all the things I was worried about, I don't have to worry anymore, because you know. So just walk with it. So when retirement came, that door shut, and I thought, you know what, God? This is how good you are. Football was okay. You know, football was okay. But if football was okay, just think what the rest of my life's going to be like. I'm so excited about the future. So today, 8 years after retiring, I now work for Christians in Sport full-time. I now support footballers in the four leagues who are Christians or guys searching, helping them on their journey. I'm a trustee of Sports Chaplaincy UK, because 75 football clubs have chaplains based at the club for half a day, who are chaplains to the whole club. And that prayer in the back room of Mick Mello's office about praying for the industry, I'm seeing it. I'm seeing it. There's so many Christian footballers now in the world of football. There's so many, which is great, but they need discipling. They need help. They're young men who love Jesus, but they make mistakes, big mistakes that get on the front and back pages of newspapers. Not because they're horrible guys with lots of money, it's because they're young men with lots of money that need support. And God has allowed me to be in there and help them, which is amazing. I'll finish with this. So much for 35 minutes, Philip. Sorry. Finish with this. I've made three amazing decisions in my life. The first one was to accept Jesus as my Lord and Saviour, because he has given me a hope beyond anything I could ever imagined. And for a number of you in this room, you know what that hope is. You definitely know. And what an amazing decision. I'm so, so grateful. Second amazing decision was getting married to my wife, Trish. 27 years, she's put up with me. She literally has put up with me. The journey of life is bumpy. It really is bumpy. I'd love to say to you today, everything is perfect in terms of the Primus life. It's not. But Jesus keeps walking us through any obstacle that comes. He walks us through. And we don't like the stuff that comes in as well. Let me tell you that. We don't go, oh, great, that's happened. We don't. But he keeps walking us through because of his word, which is amazing. And the third amazing decision was a tackle I made on Wayne Rooney. So he was just about to run into the box and score a goal. Just as he was about to shoot, I got my little toe to the ball. The ball rolled off the pitch. Rooney fell over my leg, jumped up and said, "Penalty, ref." The referee said, "No penalty." So I thought that was a good decision. So thank you very much. You've listened to a lot that I've said. We are going to have a little bit of a Q&A, but thank you very much. And, you know, ask whatever you want. If it's too hard for me, I'll pass it on to Philip anyway, so it's fine. But thank